This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have read the phrase, the Internet of Things, but what does it really mean? To put it simply, the power of the Internet to be in all of the regular objects that we use today. For example, what if your umbrella were able to tell you when you'd need it, or your prescription bottle lit up when it was time for you to take your pills? These things already exist, and our next guest not only helped develop them, but he's willing to bet that the real future of the Internet is an array of connected things, not the slab of glass that is in your pocket. David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, specializing in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here.
So what is an enchanted object?
Well, I believe that we need a new type of relationship with our technology. You know, today we have these glass slabs that we all carry around, these smartphones or phablets or tablets in our pocket, and they're incredibly demanding of our attention. We seem to be glued to them most of the day. And because of that, it really diminishes the moments that we spend with others in the world. And the vision for an enchanted object is when all of the apps and all of the things that we do with our phones leap off of the screen into everyday objects. And the result is a much simpler, much more tangible, an interaction with technology that's really preferable over this convergence device.
So what might an example be of something that we use now? I guess I'm thinking of the Fitbit.
Right. Well, rather than having to go to an app to see how many steps you've gotten, instead you can just wear a bracelet. I'm actually wearing one right now that shows you through five little LEDs sort of how many steps you've taken today. And so that's an example of really simplifying an interface and embedding it into an everyday object, in this case jewelry. And enchanted objects will be, almost – It's hard to imagine things that won't be connected. You know, we have examples of there's a tennis racket that has an accelerometer in it, which basically measures how well you're hitting, where you're hitting, whether it's a forehand or backhand shot. You know, these things are getting embedded into sports equipment, into jewelry, into furniture. I have a Facebook coffee table sitting in the middle of my living room that allows me to sort of see in a very passive way the photos that friends are taking, because the Facebook coffee table listens to the conversation. And when I mention people or places that appear in photos, it sort of gradually shows those photographs in the middle of the living room.
I've also watched a really charming video of you at your home with your son looking over the Google Maps in your coffee table.
Yeah, that's right.
Lots of information in your coffee table.
I think that's sort of that's the promise of an enchanted object, is you take all of these services and all of these apps, and you can sort of have the best version of them. You know, you can have a map that's quite large, or a Skype connection between my kid and my parents that they can just access simply by opening a cabinet. So we have this Skype cabinetry, which offers a dedicated connection, which just means they talk much more frequently.
So these all sound like objects of the future and, I guess, present in your home. But you point out that there are enchanted objects that we've looked to in the past. The barometer is one that you mention.
Right. When I was growing up, I grew up in the Midwest in Madison, Wisconsin. My father, who's a physician, had sort of a ritual that he would perform every morning. He would get up and leave their bedroom, and on the way to their bathroom with his towel wrapped around his waist, he would tap this beautiful old brass barometer and sort of see which direction the barometric pressure was trending. And as a designer, I was always admired that incredibly simple interaction paradigm of, it's just an object. It's always on. It's always showing information that's relevant. It gives you the change in that information. Like, what a simple, delightful, intuitive experience. You didn't need to ever upgrade the apps. It never made you feel stupid. It was a beautiful object that sort of fit into the home. So, it had this sort of sense of adornment to it. So I hope that we can design interfaces that are just as lovely and that we appreciate having around in our lives as that sort of barometer.
Well, the word enchanted brings up thoughts of what is magic or mystical, but it is really just technology and circuits and programming and software, is the idea that we don't really know how it works. It just presents.
Yeah, I recently did a workshop at the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute with a magician, and the students took everyday objects, in this case from IKEA, and made them enchanted. So there was a magic lantern that would listen to the story that you're telling your child and display lighting effects like thunder and lightning. There was some shades that knew if you were in front of them, and they would open or close based on whether you needed privacy or more sunlight. So these are, you know, everyday objects that have a sense of what you need and can take care of you.
You have those in your own home, according to the video I watched. You know, your shades are going up as you're pouring your coffee. Your son's having this conversation with a presumed grandparent inside of this
yes.
cabinet. But what happens to an enchanted house when the power goes out? As we saw during Hurricane Sandy, New York, New Jersey, all of these big city areas that were dependent on power for everything, from charging their phone to gas pumps, was gone.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things you learn from interacting with magicians is that they don't reveal the mechanism of the trick. You know, things are more enchanted if they just work and always work, and you don't need to know all of the circuitry and all of the whether it's connecting through the Wi-Fi network or through the phone or through the cellular network. And I think increasingly, to address your power question, I'm working with a company called Sunsprite, which is making a little clip, almost like a tie clip or button, that detects whether you get enough bright light in the morning, so that your mood improves, and it also resets your circadian rhythm, so you're more likely to sleep, to get a full night's sleep. And what's nice, what's really magical about that device is you never have to charge it. It has a little piece of solar, a little photovoltaic recharger on it, like those old calculators did. And so you never have to plug it in and you never have to charge it. So, like, that's really magical if these things just work and can harvest power either from the sun or from movement, then you never have to worry about power outages.
So we're kind of imagining this place where all of our objects work together. It's kind of Jetson's home in my mind. Those 1950 commercials about the home of the future and these enchanted systems. But where is, you know, the Rosie the robot that we've been promised for years and years? Is this the enchanted object taking the place?
Well, in the book, I talk about six different aspirations that have been revealed through fairy tales or through the Jetsons or through Bilbo Baggins and The Hobbit, or, you know, sort of fantasy stories or science fiction. And I try to organize the coming Internet of Things into these six buckets. And they are omniscience, the interest in being all-knowing; telepathy, connecting to other humans; safekeeping, like protection; immortality, having a long and quantified maybe life; teleportation, sort of friction-free travel; and creative expression, that is the ability to play and to learn in a new way. Those are all aspirations that are revealed through narratives, you know, through fiction, through myth. And I think those are the things that we should work on as inventors and innovators to try to satisfy those age-old desires.
Those human desires and drives are aspirations, things that are bringing us forward. What is your sort of nightmare of the future?
Well, I teach at the Media Lab, and there are lots of different ways to envision our relationship to technology. You know, the glass slab that I talk about is one future, one where we have this call and response relationship to technology and we're sort of lost in our screens. Another future is when everything becomes wearable. And I think that's sort of a nightmare future, because you remember when we all would wear headphones and listen to different music, and that really cut us off socially from other people? If everyone's wearing a headphone and listening to something different, it's hard to interact with other people. Just imagine what happens when everyone's wearing a Google Glass-like display and seeing a different view of reality. Another future that I also think is a nightmare is one where the technology isn't located in and on us, but it's distributed into social robots. The robotics community really wants to believe in robots that have human likeness, that have the same ambulatory, you know, can walk around, can interact with us just like we interact with other people. And the more that we get closer and closer to human likeness, the more that we'll be creating things that appear to us as zombies or the old Jewish folklore Gollum. Hmm. And the more that they will threaten our own humanity and we won't want to live with them. So I think that's another nightmare future is human-like robots. So I think that really the most preferable future is when we have this huge array of tools, of things that we ordinarily use in the world that all get imbued with a little bit more intelligence. And that's sort of where I hope computers will go.
But what about our concerns about data? You know, all of this is based on data. Do you have any concerns about what happens to that information in this era when data privacy has been compromised in so many ways?
Yeah, I think it's a great point and an important thing to be worried about. I certainly when we designed the Vitality GloCap, we imagined that there are lots of reasons that other people might want to participate in the knowledge of whether people took a medication or didn't take a medication. But we made all of those services an opt-in. So the first principle is don't make it a default in and then an opt-out, but instead make it the inverse, which is if you want an email to go to a loved one every week that shows whether you did or didn't take a med, like my GloCaps, I share data with my father and he shares his data with me. So we can give each other a helpful nudge if we're not doing very well. And so people don't have to do that. If you don't want the data to go to a doctor, you don't have to. If you don't want the data to go to a pharmacy to facilitate an automatic refill of that medication, you don't have to. So I think, you know, the first principle is be clear and make everything an opt-in. I think an important second principle that my industry needs to do a better job at communicating and providing is an absolution button. With my Nest internet-connected thermostat, I should be able to say, forget everything you ever knew about me.
Hmm.
You know, like stop learning, because that some of these objects are all about learning you so that you don't have to learn it, but it can learn you over time and it can take care of you over time. But you should be able to just clear its memory. You know, every world religion has a metaphor for absolution. Mm-hmm. It's mostly about a forgetting, right?
Right.
And these objects should give you forgiveness / absolution / lobotomize, you know, so you can start afresh.
David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia. I've really enjoyed it.
David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, and he specializes in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. Now, you can find a link to watch a short video of David in his home from the New York Times at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You know the old saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, for passionate collectors, that holds especially true. Our next story illustrates the old maxim quite literally and comes to us from McSweeney's monthly program, The Organist.
My name is Nathan Salzberg. I'm the curator of the Alan Lomax Archive. In late March 2010, I got a phone call from a friend here in Louisville that a friend of a friend had been on a dumpster job that afternoon and had brought home from that job a few boxes of 78 RPM records. Knowing that I have an interest in music of the 78 era, which is roughly the late teens to the early 40s, he called me and I was lying on the sofa, sort of not interested in going out that night. But I got up off the sofa and I drove over to the house and there were maybe 15 boxes of 78s on the floor and filled with, you know, 20, 25 78s a box. The stuff was never really built to last to begin with, and folks who bought the stuff often didn't hold on to it or didn't treat the records well, so they haven't survived. But I didn't have my hopes up, but I started looking, and right away I started seeing these names like, you know, Carter Family, Uncle Dave Macon, Jimmy Rogers, the big stars of the era. But as I kept going, I started seeing rarer and rarer records. And then I found a Mississippi John Hurt record. I mean, as a friend told me in the other room, I went pale and just said, we have got to go to this house. Like, we've got whatever, wherever the rest of these records are, we have to get them now.
those daily.
They had gotten the contract to clean out this house of a fellow whose name was Don Wall. And it was obvious that this guy had a considerable record collection of vernacular music from the 20s and 30s.
Please don't take my life. I got two little babies and a darling loving wife. That bad man.
So six of us piled into two cars. We drove out to Preston Highway on sort of the lip of the south end of Louisville. There was a full moon, and under the full moon, we dove into the dumpster, pulling out maybe 30 boxes of 78s. A friend of mine went in headfirst and came up with ketchup on his brow. There were all these bottles of family-sized ketchup in the dumpster. We weighed down two pickup trucks pretty well and then drove back to the house where my friends had been hanging out and proceeded to dig through some of the records. But apparently there were all these records left in the house. So I went home that night and I slept a very fitful night's sleep. And I woke up at about dawn the next day and waited until a decent hour to call the dumpster guy. I think I called him around 8. And he said, by all means, come out to the house this afternoon and anything you can take will be something we don't have to lug out. So that afternoon, I drive out to Preston Highway and they let me in. They give me a dust mask and I go downstairs and the place is just a disaster. I mean, the guy just lives in squalor. And I just sit in to carrying boxes up and just box after box after box after box upstairs. Things were coated in mold. I didn't have gloves on and my hands were just completely black. This was recorded in 1927 in Atlanta by a group called the Georgia Crackers, which was a couple of brothers named Paul and Leon Kofer and their friend Ben Evans, who played the guitar. And they were sons of a sawmill operator and also a hymnal compiler. And they learned their tunes, by and large, from their dad's sawmill men. Tony Russell, who really is sort of the world's expert on this stuff, had the very best description of this band, and he called them the sound of a band playing on the precipice of disintegration. When you hear a record like that, and especially when you've listened to country music from the 50s through the 70s, even outlaw music sounds like almost sounds like chamber music compared to that. I mean, that just sounds like it's totally hell for leather. It's like falling apart at the seams. They sound like they're racing to get the song in before the record ends. They know they only have about 3 minutes. Ultimately, we found the collection consists of, about 2,500 items in what we call the Don Wall collection now. 99% of them are hillbilly records. So there's all of this just phenomenal and extremely rare string band material, all from all of these places, like, you know, in rural Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina. What's great about the recordings made in the 20s and 30s is they were often made, not always, but they were often made locally. There were field recording sessions set up, and it just flushed out all of these just phenomenal, I mean, really characteristic local artists that had local styles that sounded like where they were from. Donald Pickett Wall, 75, died March 23rd. He left behind a brother, two nephews, and a niece. Cremation was chosen, and there was no funeral.
I have heard of a land on a faraway strand. Tis the beautiful home of the soul.
And that story was produced by Matt Frassica for The Organist. Word of Mouth returns, we're going to hear about a proposal for how to relegate machines. Who should govern robots? We'll explore that question when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1927, President Calvin Coolidge signed a bill into law creating the Federal Radio Commission. Before that time, anyone who applied for a broadcasting license could get one. So as the number of stations grew, so did competition and crowding on the airwaves. 7 short years later, the 5-person FRC was abolished, and Broadcasting Authority was handed over to the Federal Communications Commission we know today. Almost 90 years later, one man is arguing to revive the FRC, not for regulating radio, but robotics. Ryan Kahlo is assistant professor at the University of Washington School of Law and former research director at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. He recently authored a paper called The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission, and it was published by the Brookings Institution. Ryan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan, this sort of idea, on the face of it, sounds a little silly. Do people take it seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have been taking it quite seriously, serious enough, in fact, to criticize it extensively. And I think that it's interesting, when I first started doing robotics law a few years ago, I would go to give a talk or I'd talk about my work, and people would sort of react and be like, "You're working on robotics law, you must be thinking about Isaac Asimov or the 3 laws of robotics," and maybe with a little chuckle. But today we recognize that robotics is increasingly a part of our lives, and we've seen the law already begin to react to it. And so a proposal like this is taken, I think, as it should, on its merits.
So why an agency? Why not have existing agencies pick up some of the jurisdiction? Healthcare robots could be dealt with by the FDA or HHS, or the Highway Traffic Safety Administration might deal with self-driving cars, for example.
Well, that's exactly how it's being done today. So, of course, the Federal Aviation Administration deals with drones and et cetera. The Securities and Exchange Commission deals with high-speed trading algorithms. I'm not saying that these particular agencies should not be handling the robotics and artificial applications that they already do. Rather, I'm proposing that in order for the agencies to accrue expertise faster, that they'd have a body that was a central repository for expertise. So the idea would be that the FAA would continue to regulate drones, but when it had an issue that came up, for instance, certifying whether the sense and avoid technology in the drone were safe enough, it would have a trusted, impartial repository of expertise that it could go to for help.
What sort of hypothetical issues can you imagine now that would be difficult to address without a robotics commission?
Well, I mentioned in the paper a few years ago the notion of sudden acceleration and the question of whether or not that was a software glitch that caused Toyotas to suddenly accelerate. And Congress asked the Department of Transportation to figure it out, and it couldn't. And it had to recruit NASA. It had to went to NASA and say, "Hey, would you mind taking a break from putting, robots on Mars or repairing a space station to look at this Toyota for us?" And that's fine to do every once in a while. But as more and more activities become a function of software and hardware, you're not going to be able to turn to something like NASA each time. And so in the paper, I go through a bunch of, not hypothetical, but actual problems we're experiencing today where the relevant agencies are not making much traction. One of them involves, from your wonderful intro, the Federal Communications Commission. It's trying to figure out how to get smarter radios that can hop between frequencies and change their power. It's been trying to do that for 10 years. Everybody agrees it's a good idea. It's more efficient to have smarter radios, but no one can figure out how to do it in a way that's safe and palatable. And that's partly because they just don't have the expertise to assess it. Another example I mentioned was, one of the really important things with drones is going to be if they're going to fly autonomously, like for instance to do delivery of goods at your house as Google and Amazon plan to do. If you're going to have autonomous drones, they're going to need to be able to sense and avoid one another, and someone's going to have to certify whether that technology is working. Right now, the FAA, in my view, just doesn't seem to have the understanding of the technology to let it proceed easily. And so as a consequence, they're saying no autonomy at all. And so these are the sorts of puzzles that I think that a Federal Robotics Commission could help with.
And tying both of those together, the idea of self-guided drones and cars that accelerate by themselves, the idea of driverless cars, how will those be regulated? Or what sort of questions might come up that the FRC might address?
Well, right. So when Nevada first, Nevada was a real pioneer here. And in fact, the states have been taking the lead on driverless cars. And I think that's very appropriate. You know, historically, licensing cars and so forth has been a state-by-state power. And so they wrote the first driverless car legislation. But when they did so, they really didn't have anybody to ask about it. I mean, they had Google telling them what they thought was the right approach, and that's one company with a particular implementation, but they didn't really have anybody to turn to. That would have been a great instance for them to be able to turn to the Federal Robotics Commission. One of the things they might have avoided, for instance, is a definition of artificial intelligence that just didn't work. And if you look at the state of Nevada, they passed a law defining artificial intelligence, and because it didn't work, they ended up having to repeal that law soon thereafter and then pass a new definition. And those sorts of things, I think, would be avoided if you had non-industry, trusted government expert body in order to weigh in on these issues.
We're speaking with Ryan Kahlo. He's a law professor who argues that America needs a new federal agency for coping with questions related to robotics and their increasing role in our everyday lives. His paper, The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission, was published by the Brookings Institution. Okay, so imagine what this would look like. How big would it be? Who might it employ?
Well, I think it would be small at first. I think it would employ a group of PhDs trained in the relevant areas. And when I say the relevant areas, I mean we would have to isolate the specific kinds of interesting issues, difficult issues that robotics raises. So that would be people who are electrical engineers, computer scientists, people working on human-robot interaction. And they would be available, much in the same way as the Congressional Research Service is available to answer Congress's questions, they would be available to work on these issues. When they weren't being asked directly by, say, an agency, they didn't have a particular problem that they were parachuting in to help with, they would generate knowledge. They would do research. They would talk to stakeholders. They would have a role, I think, in channeling funding to the appropriate places and so forth. You know, there would be a low, hopefully very low-level amount of bureaucracy. But you're talking about not a lot of people here. You're talking about fewer than 100 people, most of whom were trained experts in areas of relevance to robotics.
You've mentioned that your paper has been taken seriously enough to be criticized. What are some of the criticisms of your proposal?
So far, some of the most sort of, I think, interesting and fair criticisms of the proposal have been, number one, is it really just going to be an advisory capacity? Doesn't the history of government show that something like this is going to morph into a more regulatory body and it would be inappropriate to have top-down regulation of this technology? That's one, I think, very fair concern that people have voiced. Another has to do with Is robotics really distinct enough from its previous and constituent technologies, like computers and the Internet, that it deserves separate treatment? I mean, these points are well taken. I try to address them in the paper. But, I feel like I've already succeeded at one level because the whole point of this thought experiment is to get people thinking about the right legal and policy infrastructure of robotics. And I've offered the idea of a federal robotics commission, but other people have offered the idea of principles or the idea of specific laws or other, a global think tank was an interesting idea I've heard, or, the Robo-Law project in Europe is coming out with a comprehensive set of principles based on case studies that they did. So there's all kinds of different options. I think the only really poor option here, Virginia, is not to do anything. I think not doing anything, especially in the United States, will lead to poor policy outcomes, and maybe we won't realize the benefit of this technology.
So you're talking about need for a federal robotics agency, but, we don't have a federal Internet Commission. I think all of that, or most of it, is handled by the FCC. Isn't there a stronger case to be made that there should be a way to advocate for, to initiate policy, and to interface with states on Internet law?
Well, I mean, you hear the claim from time to time that that there should be heavier regulation of the Internet. I don't agree with that. I think that what happened with the Internet was a pretty interesting and unique thing. It wasn't that it was not governed. There are things like ICANN and the technical bodies that govern the internet that actually do get together and set the protocols that determine the internet. They do so at a global level. That's because the internet is, of course, intrinsically global in a way that robotics is not, in a sense. But I will point out that the health of the internet has been a product of laws. And there are people who say, oh, we should have been, you know, we should be hands off of the internet. Well, Congress passed a very important law around the internet in the mid-90s called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which immunized platforms like Facebook for what users do on those platforms. We also passed rules for what to do about copyright on the internet. And these two kinds of regulations, along with these governance bodies that I mentioned, and also until recently, some at least understandings or norms around net neutrality, not allowing ISPs and networks to control what happens on those networks overly, have been crucial to the internet becoming the commercial and political and cultural force that it is today. So the idea that, you know, we didn't do anything with the internet, we shouldn't do anything with robotics, that's historically obviously false. And I'm hoping that the Federal Communications Commission will listen to the overwhelming will of the people and give us some solid net neutrality rules going forward. But other than that, I think that we're in a pretty good place when it comes to the internet. And I think that we had the technical and legal expertise in place because of some early interventions and because these governance bodies occurred.
Ryan Calo, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Washington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan's also a former research director at Stanford Center for Internet and Society and authored the paper, The Case for a Federal Robotics Commission. It was published by the Brookings Institution, and you'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. While lawyers and academics work out the regulatory demands of robots, there's one android in development that New Englanders would welcome, a robot that can rid your yard of ticks. Scientists at the Virginia Military Institute are working on such a robot that could help reduce the risk of tick-borne illnesses. Kelly Libby has the story.
Meet the Tick Rover. It's a robot that looks like a toy remote control truck. David Livingston is on the team that invented this mini exterminator. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Virginia Military Institute.
We designed it to be robust in the areas with logs and sticks and pine cones and that type of thing so that it won't be stopped by minor obstacles. It'll just, you know, roll over them.
If you hate ticks, you might appreciate what this little four-wheeled machine can do. It's capable of killing most, if not all, of the ticks in a whole backyard. And how do you do that? By giving ticks what they love, our breath. Sullivan and his colleagues have figured out a way to lure the ticks using a tube with holes punched in it that releases carbon dioxide. To the ticks, that CO2 release is essentially a big, glorious, intoxicating human exhalation. The rover then rolls along the tube, picking up the lovesick ticks using something else ticks love, your jeans. The machine is outfitted with what's essentially a denim skirt. The rover drags a piece of fabric behind it, and the ticks crawl on. The fabric is laced with a poison that enters the ticks' bodies through their feet, and they die. So if all goes well in trials, will this mean the end of ticks? Holly Gaff says no.
I don't think we should ever try to eliminate ticks. They're certainly a huge part of the ecosystem.
She's the rover team's tick expert and an associate professor of biological sciences at Old Dominion University.
They do serve as a prey source for a lot of other animals. So if you start saying, well, let's eliminate all ticks, well, you'd eliminate a lot of those birds that may rely on that for a lot of their food source. And so ecologically, it's not a good idea.
But that's the nice thing about the rover. It targets a small area. The area of your yard where ticks live.
We will give them the woods, but we're not giving them our yard. We will give them, you know, the deep woods there, but not the paths along that we want kids to be able to play in.
They're still testing the product, but your honey-do list of leaf blowing, gutter cleaning, and pruning the hedges could very soon include tick roving. I'm Kelly Libby.
Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at prison gangs, the brutal but effective custodians of order and governance behind bars. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. Stay with us.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the possible exception of North Korea, America is the world leader in incarceration. With one in 108 people in jail, it is the country with the largest percentage of its population behind bars. It also has several of the world's most notoriously violent prison gangs, membership in which is a means of survival, as California inmate Brian Curlis tells a documentary film crew.
My idea was that we couldn't organize the Mexicans, we can't organize the blacks, but we could organize the whites.
Pelican Bay State Prison is a supermax penitentiary in Crescent City, California, where those high up in the gang hierarchy are held in the tightest lockdown in the state. Graham Wood, contributing writer for The Atlantic, visited the prison to explore an academic theory that, in their own brutal and effective way, prison gangs have become the unlikely custodians of governance and order behind bars. In an article called How Prison Gangs Took Over, Wood dispels some myths about prison gangs and explores their influence over life on the outside. Graham Wood, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Graham, you visited Pelican Bay State Prison. This is in Crescent City, California, where a number of high-level gang members have been incarcerated. Now, you were there when corrections officers were watching inmates file out into the yard. What did you see?
Well, I should first say what I expected to see. Now, you think of these prisoners who are there because they've broken the law. And according to the California prison authorities, they're also there because they're gang members. That's where they try to concentrate gang members in the California system. So you expect to see some kind of disorder, a lot of people who don't like following the rules. And instead, what you see is an immensely rule-bound atmosphere. People walk out in a particular order. They sit in a particular place. And even once the groups start forming in these clusters in the places where they've staked out and kind of planted the flag of the particular race or gang, then they send out scouts in a particular way, and they walk in very carefully chosen patterns. So what I expected to see was disorder, and what I saw, in fact, was one of the more orderly environments you could find.
Mm. You wrote in the article about sort of color-coding inmates so that they were in safe numbers within their own gangs. Are they acknowledging that these gangs exist, so we just want to work with it, or what are they doing to prevent?
If you ask the California authorities, they'll say that they've produced a very carefully orchestrated systems so that gangs can be mitigated in their effects. In practice, what that means is that they look at the gang structures and in some ways they replicate it in their own system. Every inmate gets a color-coded identification card, and that card really corresponds to the presumptive gang that he's a member of. And in many ways, you see that the California system really works with the gangs in a way that it probably wouldn't appreciate my characterizing it that way, but there's no doubt that the institution and the informal institutions that are incarcerated there are in some ways in cahoots just to keep order in California prisons.
Hmm. Well, tell us more about that. Some of the research on prison gangs' origins and behavior that you quote in the article comes from David Scarbeck. He's an economist, I believe. When did prison gangs first appear in American penal systems and why?
In California in particular, prison gangs first appeared in the 1950s, which is an interesting thing because California has had prisons for at least 100 years before that. So the question that David Scarbeck, who, as you say, is a political economist in London, was trying to figure out was why did California prison gangs only arise after the prison system had been around for so long? And the answer that he came away with was that California prisons had particular demographic shocks and shifts that took place around that period and in the decade or so that followed. And before then, you would have prisoners coming in, doing their time, and really just telling each other as they came in how to act when you're in prison. Do this, don't do that, don't rat on people, don't take other people's stuff. Mm-hmm. And the incoming prisoners would learn how to behave that way.
So there was the sort of a convict code of sorts.
Precisely. Yeah. And it was possible in a very informal way to indoctrinate new arrivals. What Scarbeck found was that around that period, you started to see lots of people showing up, and a lot of people who were coming to prison for the first time and who were from demographic groups that might not play well with others, really young men, for example. And so when they came in, they could no longer be assimilated with the convict code, and instead you had a prison system that really cried out for some kind of order that was no longer being provided by the previous means. And that's where prison gangs stepped in.
And this was flourishing when?
This was from 1956 for the couple decades that followed that were really the genesis moments for what we now think of as the California prison gangs.
Let's look at some of the misconceptions about how prison gangs operate. One, that there is unresolvable hatred between them, and that they are simply street gangs locked up. What are we not understanding in that statement?
Well, you know, some of the gangs seem to exist only for the purposes of racial hatred. The Black Guerrilla Family would be one group whose name really describes it as much as you need to know, but also the Aryan Brotherhood. And there are two Hispanic gangs, which you really can't be a member of unless you're Hispanic. So it looks on the surface like these gangs exist because they want to promote the supremacy of a race. In fact, you see that the gangs get along in some ways quite well in a transactional way with each other. And a lot of people who you would think have ideological commitments to race hatred, those really vanish when it comes to living cheek by jowl with other gangs and getting along with them.
One of the things I found really fascinating is that the threat of prison is nothing compared to the threat of the prison gang. It actually ripples out onto the street. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, if you're on the street and you rob a drug dealer who's affiliated with a prison gang, then you might be able to get away for a while. You could just move to another city, for example. But the prison gangs know that if you're the type of person who's out there robbing drug dealers, there's a really good chance you're going to end up on the inside too. And that means that prison gangs, according to Scarbeck's thesis, perform a function for criminal enterprises on the outside, which just allows them to know that someday they'll be able to find you. When you appear in prison, you'll get back on that gang's radar, and they keep meticulous records, so they know if you've ripped off someone on the outside, and they'll come get you and exact revenge when eventually, as you surely will, you end up in prison too.
Graham Wood is with us. He wrote an article for The Atlantic called How Gangs Took Over Prisons. Scarbeck also considers prison interaction and behavior from a market-based model. So talk to us about some of the skills developed for communication, for initiation, for leadership inside of the prison gangs.
Well, one skill is human resources. When you arrive, there is something called a new arrivals questionnaire, an NAQ, which will be passed to you in your cell, and you'll be expected to answer a lot of questions. Things like what bars you drank at on the outside, what your offenses were, who your associates were, who else you know in prison. So the gangs, to be effective, really need to know what their resources are. And so they will take very careful records of what you say, and they'll even verify it.
Fact check them.
Yes, they have accounts on news services and social media, so they can go to see if you really are friends with so-and-so and whether you're going to be useful for the gang in the ways that you say. I should say that California prisons prohibit possession of cell phones at all. So when inmates have them and are able to fact-check people this way, it's because they have a pretty sophisticated way of getting contraband, keeping it, and using it for the gang's ends.
In fact, you quote that in 2013, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation confiscated 12,151 phones. A reasonable guess, about a tenth of all cell phones in the system. So how many have them?
Well, the total number of inmates in the California system is about 10 times 12,000. So statistically, that means that about one cell phone might have been confiscated per inmate in the entire system. There are some prisons where there are no cell phones confiscated at all. But the size of this number really demonstrates the degree to which inmates have free reign of the place.
And in prison, these cell phones are held in body cavities. I will say that as discreetly as I possibly can.
Yes, that's one thing that Scarbeck details. It was information given to him by a corrections officer from San Quentin, who said that cell phones are kept in the only private place that inmates have, which is body orifices. And if you want to know what kind of cell phone an inmate has, you look at the bar of soap that he has, because he might need to keep an orifice supple and properly sized for his particular handheld device. And so the bar of soap will be kept in the proper shape as a placeholder.
So you just mentioned that, you know, the number of cell phones helps illustrate that the prison system really doesn't have much of a hold on how these gangs operate or the prisoners operate. So what is being done? What are some of the strategies for breaking down the considerable power inside of prisons?
The reason the gangs arose in the first place was because the prison system in California was deeply disordered, and it remains so. And they have really tried all manner of things that many people would call unconstitutional to try to break up prison gangs. One effort that I saw, which really goes beyond what you find in any prison system elsewhere in the United States, is what they call the SHU at Pelican Bay, and that's the Secure Housing Unit. And what this is essentially is a large part of the prison where every inmate is held in solitary confinement, in some cases for many years at a time. And really, this is at the farthest edge of the envelope of what we think of as permissible for American human rights and civil liberties. It does do one thing, though, which is keep people from talking to each other, and it severely disrupts what gang members and anyone else who happens to be in that facility can do to organize themselves and run a big organization from the inside.
You know, solitary confinement is being used increasingly in American penitentiaries as a threat, as a deterrent. But you mentioned, you know, furthest edge of what is permissible, in fact, something that human rights organizations are advocating against. Is it truly effective?
It's effective in that individuals who are kept there are prevented from talking to other people and from organizing in any easy way anyway. Whether it's effective is not, of course, the only question that we have to ask about it. Is the price that we pay for the dehumanizing and true psychological pain that we cause to these people worth paying in order to disrupt an individual's ability to run a gang? After all, the gangs do perfectly well even without their heads being completely in the loop.
Well, I'm going to stay on that for just a second, because this is something that you've been criticized for, or your article has been criticized for. I'm speaking of Shane Bauer. He was held captive in Iran for 2 years, reported on prisons. Writing in Mother June's magazine, he took great exception to your article, especially what he called, quote-unquote, justifying the use of long-term solitary confinement. What do you say to that?
I think you should read the article a little more carefully. My job was to go there to describe what I saw, and what I saw looked pretty torturous to me. The description that I gave of the Pelican Bay SHU was of a place that had really the air of dystopian science fiction to it. I described it as the kind of place where humans were placed in suspended animation against their will. That sounds pretty horrifying, and I wouldn't hesitate to call it torture. He found that description not so bad, which is funny, because he has written well about Pelican Bay from the perspective not of a journalist but of an advocate of the human rights of prisoners. And I quite agree with him that the Pelican Bay SHU is an affront to certainly what I would like in a society that I'm part of. But my job was to describe what I saw there, and I saw something horrifying, and I placed it in the context of this view of prisons as a place that that it's broken down enough that we have to rely on prison gangs for maintenance of order. Mm. The SHU is something that I described as another way we can do that, and I hope it's not an option that recommends itself very much based on what I've described.
Well, Graham Wood, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Graham Wood, a contributing writer for The Atlantic. A link to read his article, How Prison Gangs Took Over, is on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most interesting stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.